Could a pedagogical planner be a useful learning design tool for university lecturers? So I would like you to think about that in light of what you've just heard, because I think it poses an interesting question. I'm now going to do the presentation, so I will move. When we started talking about pedagogical planners, we had an issue instantly about the definition. And on some levels, what we're talking about is something that builds courses. On other levels, people were talking about just a lesson. And it didn't have to be online, it could be any sort of lesson, but something that helped people build a lesson. Then on a micro level, we also found that people were interested in them to just build a particular activity, and that activity could last 10 minutes or over a whole semester. And then the issue that we discussed was, should this be an educational tool? That is, as the person moves through, should we be trying to instruct them on the issues that they should be thinking about? Or alternatively, provide what we seem to get a fair bit of pressure to do, and that's simply have a tool that was a shortcut for the learning design process for those people who really weren't that interested in designing a really integrated, wonderful program with a whole lot of effort. So they wanted to shortcut it, produce something good that was working, but with minimal effort, and they weren't terribly concerned about what they knew at the end of it as people themselves. So it wasn't a PD thing they were looking for. So they weren't looking for professional development at all. The need for a pedagogical tool has arisen recently at our university for a whole variety of reasons. And the biggest issue that we've had at our university is we have moved emphasis. We have a motto at our university called "And Gladly Teach." But our new Vice Chancellor decided that the emphasis now was to be on research. So we had a new group of academics employed whose expertise was research. So they felt that their emphasis and the thrust of what they were doing was to be much more focused on the research aspects. So we were suddenly inheriting a lot of academics who had not had a lot of experience in the sort of teaching we'd come to expect at our university. There is also an underlying assumption that Diana Lorillard has written two books about, and that is that there is this inherent consideration that if you have a PhD in physics, then automatically you can teach physics, usually to first-year graduates. And it does mean that that is not, as we've found our experience, that people that are exceptionally good at research, have a PhD in whatever subject, do not necessarily make excellent teachers instantly. Gibbs also in 1996 did a big survey and found that most lecturers, and this was over three countries, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, they were actually not as good teachers as they were researchers. And this is purely at the higher education level. He did this research. And they were often the best teachers almost there by accident. They were lucky. They were good at what they did almost by a fluke. I work in the area of education. I'm attached to the School of Education. And so what we do really is promote good teaching throughout our university. But we're lucky because it's our field. Most of the people that were coming to us for advice had absolutely no training or no expertise in the area of teaching. And yet that in effect was what they did for up to 10, 12 hours a week. They certainly had not had any exposure to the literature for education. So because these people were coming to us asking advice, the initial experience I had was trying to play with lambs to create something that would alert these people to things that an experienced educator would naturally consider when they were preparing a lesson. And at this time, I met James. And lambs became the focus of what we were doing because it was simple, so that the person actually delivering the lesson could also be the designer. We'd previously had a number of other pieces of software that meant we had to involve educational developers. And the problem was we had this intermediary that was told what the lecturer wanted, and then the educational developer would go off and design it, and then come back, and it wasn't always exactly what the lecturer wanted. Or perhaps it was exactly what they thought they wanted, but in practice it didn't work. And then they had to edit it. And because of a whole variety of reasons, it put another step in the process, and it wasn't immediately and online. So this was the first, I guess, idea that we came up with. For those of you who've never really had any idea of what a pedagogical planner is, this is our first concept. And what it was is a list of teaching strategies, if you like, for people who truly had no idea what they were doing from the first step. So there was four options in this particular case of teaching strategies. If someone wanted to teach alternative perspectives, for example, this is a plan of how they might do it, the things that they might have to consider. And you'll see there's a little pop-up box there. So it comes up when they click on why would I use this? So what we were trying to do was to scaffold or guide these people who truly had no idea how to go about starting this process of how, in an instructive way, they might construct this lesson. There's also a lot of talk about problem-based learning. We had a number of experienced lecturers who'd heard about it, thought perhaps it would work in their particular discipline, but truly had no idea how to go about structuring it, what it really meant. And the third option there we came up with was project or case study focused lessons. And then the last one was role play. There's quite a big fashionable thing happening in Australia at the moment with role play. But again, if you haven't used role play before, the steps required to go through it can be a bit daunting. The next step that we had was, there's actually a LAM sequence down the left-hand side, and for those of you who are quite familiar with LAMs, you'll see that it's a fairly straightforward structure. Very, very linear in this case. On the right-hand side, people can be just required to cut and paste text. And that is the most basic level, not particularly instructive or providing any professional development if they choose not to. But if they do want to learn about it, they can click on the Need Help box and it will start to explain why they're doing what they're doing and the options that are available to them. Now, at the same time as we were starting to play with this, what is now a very rudimentary idea, there suddenly became a whole lot of other planners. Our planner originally, we decided, should be a step-by-step guide so that we would help people through, allow them to make some informed decisions, choose the right tools and resources for what they want. But there's a whole lot of other things out there now that had quite different purposes. Incidentally, often did that, but that wasn't their main role. The next one was to inspire lecturers to adopt new teaching strategies, which again was incidentally what ours was trying to do for people who really had no idea. Goodyear is a Sydney academic now. He's looking at it as a way to actually document learning designs. This makes them very transportable, but it's a very visual attempt at recording what's actually happening in the planning of learning design. And it does provide a really clear description of what is expected. What's come up since that, and particularly in areas like LAMS community, is this concept of reuse. Now in reality, which is quite nice in a way, our experience with reuse has been very minimal. That is, people go to LAMS community and see what other people are doing. But we've discovered that very rarely do they ever use that completely. They use that as inspiration and they move on and develop it and edit it and change it. And fortunately, in the software that we're using, which is LAMS, you get to the point where the lecturer can edit it. So it does become extremely flexible. There's Gronje's mechanism for abstracting good practice and metamodels for learning. And I read that so I didn't get it wrong. The reuse aspect also does allow you to produce a runnable lesson. So if someone isn't confident about how the lesson might flow, in an online environment, you can actually create something that runs. It also means that this encoding of the design in a way that makes it incredibly iterative and allows you to continually update and edit was incredibly important to what we were trying to do. So even in our very, very early conceptual ideas, one of the most important factors was we had to have the ability, the lecturer that was actually delivering the lesson had to be able to edit it even on the spot, even after the lesson had begun to be run, because we knew that this education process was such a fluid and changeable operation. So why now have we got suddenly this great influx of these tools when really online environments have allowed this to happen for many, many years? In our particular example, and coincidentally it happened in the UK to some extent, but also New Zealand, our higher education area has been restructured. So it means now that we are educating the masses, so to speak. These students are quite different to the students that had been traditional Australian university students. They, for the first time, vary incredibly in ability. Previously, only the top 6% of our students had gone to university, so they were only the cream. You could stand there and lecture, and those students would sponge up everything you said without question, which in itself is a little of a worry. But now we have an incredibly wide range of ability. We also have students that are incredibly wide range as far as motivation goes. Some students would rather be anywhere but there. They're after that piece of paper and that's it. The learning process itself is not of interest to them. Also, we have a wide range of students now, particularly in the last 5 to 7 years when the Australian government has stopped providing free education at university level to students. They are required now to subsidise, if you like, their education. So at some times these students are asked to pay up to $20,000 per year for their education, which I know in some countries is absolutely ridiculously low, but in Australia it was a very different mind shift. So for the first time we had students that weren't full-time students. We had students who were actually having to pay their way as they worked through university. So they couldn't come and sit at the university all day. They had to actually work during the day or during the night and come to lessons. So access to the theatres became an issue. So we moved online. The second thing was that cultural differences was huge. So we've had an influx of overseas students. One way many universities in Australia have paid their way has been by finance by our overseas students. So this means that they're not English speaking in a lot of cases. So that's created a whole new set or variety of issues. So this prompted a lot of lecturers who had stood up and just talked at their students to realise that to engage these students that were very different, they had to honestly start facilitating effective learning. They had to start employing things like effective teaching strategies, and they needed really to have some idea of the research, the strategies, approaches, the theories, and the variety of modes of delivery that they'd not necessarily come across before. So the traditional ones can be used, but they weren't the only ones that were going to work. So at this point, we were going to be in a room upstairs, so this was going to be a little bit more round table-ish. But I'd just like to get a few cross-section from the audience over whether it is just us. It seems not to be, but I'd just like to get an idea. We've just been given a grant by the Australian government to promote this project, but we're very, very concerned that we don't make it too insular. As most of you realise, Australia is quite isolated, so we would like some input from you people as to if we do produce something like this, what sort of help are the people at universities looking for? Has anyone got any thoughts?
Working almost alone. So
Absolutely. It's interesting because there has been a move also in Australia from this, what we call the cottage industry approach. That is, one person taught their unit or their course, irrespective of what anyone else was doing, and they did their thing. When they moved on, that course was obviously usually dropped from the university, and someone else with their specialty moved in, and they had very little to do with any of the people beside it. So that sounds the sort of thing that you're describing. What we have found, though, on the really big courses, the basic foundation courses, for example, like the first course that they do in Australia on education for trainee teachers, we can have 200, 300 students enrolled in that. That meant that we had to have this team approach. And what became really interesting was that we had to have these standards met by an external body, and we had to ensure those standards were being met, and the staff changed. So we had to have some way of passing this information on. So that sort of situation, if you have got that, I can see why, in a way, the sharing part of this would not be relevant. But again, we're looking at new teachers or new lecturers and whether, in effect, that they will have any benefit from this, even if they are working in isolation. And I can imagine if you were brand new and you were working in isolation and you were just handed a course, that would be incredibly terrifying if you had no idea of teaching strategies. Anyone else want to make any comments? Mm. Yeah, thank you. Anyone else? One here? Yeah, Marion. Yes, and in fact, it's really interesting when we're talking about the reuse issue. Sorry. when we're talking about the reuse issue, some of us can see that the actual design can be reused without the content, and that you can pour any sort of content in. Some designs are just inherently going to work because they're great designs. But in effect, it's interesting when you're looking at talking to practitioners. They want someone who's doing exactly psychology 101. This is what that university does. Therefore, if that's psychology 101, I'm interested. But it'll be interesting as we progress whether that mindset just continues. And we've had heavy pressure to create some designs that are discipline specific. And I can see that there's some validity in that as well, not necessarily content and all, but there are quite a lot of discipline differences between approaches. But then it has been argued perhaps that is a problem as well. Anyone else with any comments? Because we've now got a microphone. No one else? Okay. So Ramsden did a survey to have a look and see why people were actually asking for help. Interestingly, most people didn't go instantly to their educational developers for help. They tended to stick to their colleagues in their discipline, which is understandable. But it tended to come to crunch time when the students were not performing well. They realised they had a problem, but they didn't know what to do about it. There were some lecturers who just wanted to be told, yes, what you're doing is good, what you're doing is okay. Then there was others that wanted to try innovation, but these are usually the easiest ones to catch because they're always out there looking for different things. But this last category, which is the ones I felt used to come to me, the ones I felt most strongly for, were the ones that really knew what they were doing wasn't working, but they just didn't know how to fix it. So now that we've got a microphone, and in the time we've got left, which is about 5 minutes, we've sort of covered the first area with how might a pedagogical plan be best used or not. What I'd really be interested in hearing from too is those people who just think it's a total waste of time, because I think that we do have to address the issues and the concerns here if we do move forward. And we're quite prepared to spend a bit of work on this and at the end admit that although it just seemed a good idea to some of us, it's just really not practical, which I'm sure the Australian government would be devastated to hear me say that money they're throwing at us is a total waste of time. But I think you've got to admit the inevitable to some point, at some stage. And the other thing that I'm interested in is how much support should actually be provided throughout the process. Because being an educator myself, I wanted to educate these people as they went through. So at the end of it, they'd have a product, but along the way, they were guided through and shown the possibilities. And I know that if you have time this afternoon, the Phoebe Project very much concentrates on alerting people, and there's Marion down there, alerting to people of all the options that are available as they move through. So it's got a very strong instructional component. So really, should it be an instructional, have some sort of instructional purpose? Because what we have found, those people that have seized on this idea are either the people that strongly believe it should be incredibly heavy in the instructional purpose, and that is its prime objective. But then there's been a group of people that have approached us and said, oh, look, we can bunch this up into a package and then give it to our lecturers and say, you must teach like this. This is it. It meets all the standards. You must have this. And so what terrifies me is we turn into this sausage factory mentality where, from a vice chancellor's point of view at our universities, this is the perfect solution. Some clever person who knows all about teaching has developed this system in this subject, and now look, we can copy it and you can be asked to teach it exactly how that person thought, regardless of who your students are. So I guess at this stage, I'm just looking to get a feel for whether people, after really obviously showing my hand, whether people really believe that that does have a role in either of those areas, or whether we really should cut our losses at this point. I've got about 5 minutes.
Yeah. 10 minutes.
Okay, has anybody got any thoughts? Where's the mic? Doesn't sound on. Ah, that's it.
Really need a microphone for six people. When we got automatic transmissions, a lot more people started driving cars. So I think one of the difficulties we've had with instructional media design and all that sort of stuff is that we've tended to be overly complicating the process of design as opposed to come up with simplistic ways of getting things done. And I think that, you know, one of the nice things about LAMS is you can take a look at somebody else's design and copy it and reuse it with some modifications. And I think that if we have design tools that make things that easy to do, then people will use it. If we make things very introspective and very difficult, people won't use it. And that's why people don't talk to their educational designers first when they have problems, because when you talk to an educational designer, they make the thing overly complicated. All I want to do is teach. All I want is people to understand these things. I don't want to learn all this jargon and all these tools and spend 5 years of my life learning something that may or may not give me fruition. So let's go back to basic principles. Let's get an automatic transmission in there and more people will drive.
Thank you. I haven't thought of the automatic transmission analogy before, but I quite like it. Anyone else want to add anything?
No.
Up the back, Catherine.
Hello?
You need a green light.
Hello? Is that
mm-hmm.
I'm from the University of Wales, and we sort of have a half and half situation. We have one area, which is my area, the professional side of the education, which actually works very well as teams, and we have a very much a program-oriented view on planning the courses across a different aspect. But on the other area, in the undergrad and postgrad type of section, we do now have a push towards having PhD students, as you said earlier on, coming in who have had no teaching experience whatsoever, but are very strong in research. And what we're finding is that we're trying to find something to hang our hats on to get at least some discussion going about planning. And I think at least that there is something in this that would allow the discussion, the forum at least, to start talking about how you actually plan across programmes.
Mm.
But in terms of the reuse, we are very sceptical. And very much people are going down their discipline-specific good practice, if you like.
Mm. Okay, anyone with anything else to add? No? I've got a slight concern, as you know, about packaging it up and institutionalizing it so that it becomes this package. Has anyone else got concerns in that way, or has had any experience where the top-down direction is going to come, this is what you will teach and you'll have no control or editing ability? Has anybody got an institution or know of any institutions where that is likely to occur, or is some intellectual independence still out there and thriving? Do you want to just pass the mic down? The only reason why we're sort of persisting with this mic situation, yes, I understand there's not a huge crowd here, is these sessions are being recorded, so that's why we need the mic. Thank you, Marianne. Yes, absolutely. At the end of the day, everyone will be given a waiver. And I haven't identified most people. Yes, sorry, Marianne.
There are definitely people who look at it as something. I don't quite, not really quite what you're saying. It's almost a variation on that theme, which is that people aren't engaging enough with teaching and learning. And one of the ways you might get them to engage more with teaching and learning is through these mechanisms like QA, which is a big issue in the UK. And not necessarily in a, right, we're going to make everybody teach one way, but we're going to make them think about teaching at all. So there are people who like this idea of, wow, we could have, yes, our university's tool, which could turn into that vision you're talking about. I agree with you, that's a scary prospect. But there is something, again, coming back to your idea about the automatic transmission, making it easy. If there are, even if it's a tool that says, right, you want to use blogs, and we've institutionalized it, so you need to go and talk to Kevin about blogs because he's the person who knows, and it makes it easy for you to find that out, that's helpful. So
So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess the way out is at this point, that the bottom line is we're going to never take away the editability of the product. And even if we have a situation where from the top it is institutionalised as a package, those people will, the renegades, will always have the opportunity of editing. For anybody that is interested in this sort of area, and I'll do a big ad now, tomorrow we're having a day talking about a whole variety of issues to do with this sort of area. The word pedagogical planner keeps coming up, but it's really a clumsy, quite awful word, but a couple of words really. But no, I haven't heard anybody come up with anything really nice. Phoebe's a lovely name, but it's already been taken. So if anybody is interested in this, tomorrow here at 9:30, we'll be spending the day looking at a number of people that are working in this field and just tossing around some ideas like this, working out as a group, an international group, where we might head with this. So everybody's welcome, it's completely free, but we will be here tomorrow discussing this. It will also be recorded. So for those people who haven't discovered it yet, when you go onto the conference webpage, the LAMS conference webpage, we do upload anybody who's willing their